Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Cinda Crawford. And she is with me today on the phone to discuss planning for your pets in the age of COVID. Now, this is the first program that we're having during this COVID period. We have been on a break because the social distancing requirements would not make it feasible for us to have live guests in the studio. So I hope you'll all bear with me as Dr. Crawford joins me by phone. But it's an important topic, and I'm grateful to you, Dr. Crawford, for taking some time and talking to me today about this.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
Let's just kind of get a little bit of background about this disease, which I think that many people are quite familiar with now based on everything that we've been reading in the news for the last couple of months. But it comes from a virus. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a coronavirus.
It's okay if you don't have a lot of information to provide about these, but is there anything special about coronaviruses?
Coronaviruses, in fact, a number of species worldwide. Most species have their own coronaviruses that are specific for them and are not cannot infect other species. But the coronaviruses that occur naturally in bats are the ones that are most likely to spill over from an animal reservoir and acquire properties to infect people. That's what is worrisome, is that particular kind of coronavirus coming out of that particular animal reservoir.
I see. Is it likely that a coronavirus type disease has just kind of existed in the environment for a while and has now just recently made this jump?
Coronaviruses have been around for as long as we've been able to identify them, again, in a variety of animal species. It is uncommon for coronaviruses that naturally infect an animal species to acquire properties that allow them to adapt and infect people. So this is an uncommon event. It happened in 2003 with the original SARS virus that came from a bat and spread into people. Thankfully, that spread of virus among people was curtailed fairly quickly to what we're experiencing now, where another coronavirus, most likely coming from bats as the original source, is responsible for COVID and this current pandemic. So very uncommon.
Yeah, and it is affecting the world right now in a really substantial way. I mean, people listening to this program who are at home right now because work is closed or maybe they are even out of work, people who are experiencing dramatic changes in just the routines that they normally would have and having to create new routines for them and themselves and their children, it's really remarkable. And as of today, I understand that more than 80,000 Americans have died from this disease. So it is a serious illness, and it is affecting a great many people around the world, not just in the United States. One thing that we know is that if it has been in animals, right, as we know it has, what I wonder is how much it can affect our animals here.
Oh, that's a really good question, and it's a question that's been asked by many scientists, veterinarians, animal lovers around the world since the first reports of COVID coming out of China in December 2019 and January 2020. There have been 4 million cases of COVID infection documented in people around the world to date, and yet we have had documented reports of infection in our pet species, our companion animals, such as dogs and cats, less than a handful.
Okay, so that's, yeah. Well, that's reassuring.
So we do know from evidence to date that cats are particularly the more susceptible pet species to infection by the human coronavirus. Ferrets and hamsters are also susceptible to infection, but dogs are relatively resistant, and other animal species such as pigs and poultry are also resistant. So we do worry, as veterinarians, we worry more about cats, ferrets, and hamsters. But again, I would like to say that thousands of cats and dogs have been tested around the world since COVID first started, and we still only have less than 12 recorded instances of spillover of infection from a person into cats and dogs.
Okay, now that seems to bode well for our animal friends then.
Yeah. I mean,
that makes it a remarkably low infection rate, given it's a disease that has origins in animals to begin with, right?
Correct. Very low.
Now, you mentioned that dogs have some sort of resistance, it seems. Is there any understanding of why that is?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Is there any understanding as to why dogs perhaps are less susceptible to this disease?
It seems that their cells are not quite set up as well as cat cells to for virus attachment. So the lock and key mechanism for virus attachment to a host cell is a better fit for the cat than it is for the dog.
I see. Can I get you to explain that a little bit? Because it's an interesting sort of visual metaphor. I wonder if you could sort of expand it.
For virus infection of a host, there has to be a specific protein, or it's called a receptor, on the host cell surface that sticks out and is recognizable by a receptor that's on the virus surface. So the receptor on the virus surface has to match the receptor on the host cell surface in order for the two receptors to link up. And once that linkage occurs, that is the very first step of virus infection of that host cell. That linkage must occur before the virus can get into the host cell and it cause infection.
And it just happens that dogs is less plausible for that to take place.
That is correct. That's the best evidence to date that receptor for the coronavirus that causes COVID is not as good a fit for the virus as the cat is.
We have been reading stories for months about the ways in which this virus is affecting humans who are infected. Do we have any information about what is happening to the animals, like cats, that have been infected?
There have been some cats with documented coronavirus infection that acquired from an infected person that did not experience any disease at all. They were what's called asymptomatic, and the infection of the cat was picked up because testing was being conducted for a specific reason. There have been other cats that actually were tested because they're coming from a COVID household, and they had respiratory signs. So it's hard to predict, and I don't think you can predict which cat will get sick from infection by this human coronavirus and which one will get infected but not be sick. But there's been a mix of both circumstances. No cats have died specifically due to infection by the coronavirus. The ones that did get sick have recovered.
Well, that's very good to hear. I mean, this disease that has been ravaging people has mercifully so far seemed to, in addition to not really having a profound effect on animals, at least in terms of their physical health, has also spared children by and large, which is something that we can all be grateful for. I wonder, Dr. Crawford, if there is any information as to how it came to pass that many animals have been tested. Is it, as you just sort of hinted at a moment ago, that animals that were in households in which a human was infected or suspected to be infected by the coronavirus were then tested themselves?
That is correct. That is one method of documentation that some cats can get infected and that some of those infected cats can get a respiratory disease that's not fatal. The other way that we have knowledge about infection of cats and dogs, even fewer dogs, is through some surveillance testing that's been done by veterinary diagnostic laboratories. And what I mean by that is that samples from dogs and cats with a respiratory infection, so coughing or sneezing or runny nose, that had samples submitted to veterinary diagnostic laboratories in the U.S., in several European countries, in Korea, and in China to determine what was causing respiratory infections. And these pets were screened for COVID infection in addition to dog-specific respiratory viruses and cat-specific respiratory viruses. And out of the thousands of dogs and cats that were included in this surveillance testing from around the world, we still only had less than five were positive for the COVID virus.
Is there a difference between the human coronavirus test and one administered to animals?
It's not the same kits for use in animals that are reserved for use in humans. So animal testing does not interfere with the ability for people to get tested, first and foremost. But the animal tests have been devised using different types of reagents than those used for human testing, again, to spare supplies for dedication to people. But the test looks for this, in animals, looks for the same hallmarks of COVID virus infection that the human test does for humans.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Are there particular agencies who are heading up efforts to test animals and screen animals? I imagine there is a curiosity in the U.S. Department of Agriculture for at least testing of animals that are used for food, but I don't know that for sure. What about state agencies or other federal agencies? Is anybody leading the effort?
Right now, routine testing of animals for COVID-19 virus is not recommended. It's not recommended by the American Veterinary Medical Association. It's not recommended by the CDC, the USDA, our National Association of Veterinary Laboratory Diagnostics, diagnosticians, our National Association of State Public Health Veterinarians. None of these leading agencies regarding animal health recommend testing of companion animals at this time. There's the incidence of infection is so very low that it is unlikely that an animal would test positive. And so That's why routine testing of animals is not recommended. There are circumstances, though, where dogs and cats may be tested. And these are dogs and cats that have started a respiratory infection that looks like the COVID infection in people. There's coughing, runny nose, sneezing, may or may not have a fever. So these animals would be considered a candidate for testing for the coronavirus, the human coronavirus, that they may have gotten from an infected person in the household that they live in. But first of all, veterinarians have to rule out other much more common causes of respiratory infections in dogs and cats. Dogs and cats have their own respiratory viruses that cause the vast majority of respiratory infections. So if the pet lives in close contact with a person that has suspected or confirmed COVID, that pet has now acquired a respiratory infection, and it has been determined through regular routine testing that the respiratory infection is not associated with the common dog and cat viruses, then testing for COVID would be considered for that particular pet. But COVID, or this SARS coronavirus, is what we call a reportable disease. That means that infections in people must be reported to a central data collection agency, such as the CDC. And it means that infection in pets must also be reported to both the state veterinarian or public health veterinarian's office in the state in which that animal resides. Then it's reported to our federal agency. And then it gets reported to the World Organization for Animal Health. So since this is a reportable disease, any animal that's infected with the COVID virus has to be reported to state and federal and global agencies. The testing is very controlled. So there has to be a conversation between the veterinarian that's caring for the sick dog or cat, and they suspect that it needs to have COVID testing. The state veterinarian or state public health veterinarian is involved in that conversation with the veterinarian caring for the pet, and they together determine whether that pet needs to move forward with testing for COVID.
To the best of your knowledge, have many animals in Florida been tested?
There have. It's not many. You know, probably a couple or three dozen, and all, to my knowledge, were tested with approval by our state veterinarian office, and none of those animals have tested positive.
Well, here, Dr. Crawford, is where we will take our first break. We're going to remind listeners this is Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today is Dr. Cinda Crawford from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be back with more Animal Airwaves Live right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and in this recorded episode of the program, I'm talking to Dr. Cinda Crawford from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about planning for your pets in the age of COVID-19. And in our last segment, we discussed how unusual it is for our pets to become infected out of the many thousands and thousands and thousands of cases that have existed so far in the United States in people. Just a handful of pets have been infected, and none have died so far. Now, Dr. Crawford, I wonder if we have any information about whether or not it is possible for our pets to potentially infect us as people, though I would imagine given the low number of animals that have been discovered to have been infected, there are probably very few, if any, incidents of pets infecting people.
There actually is no evidence at this time that pets can spread the virus back to people. All of the expert agencies consider this possibility to be extremely low. We always have to remember that infection of people is driven by contact with an infected person, not contact with an infected pet. So we really need to just, you know, put our focus on how to prevent human-to-human spread of the coronavirus, not so much pet to human.
Well, this is reassuring, of course, for anyone who has and loves a pet, and especially in this time when our pets, as members of our family, so to speak, are isolating with us, are part of the social distancing. We're keeping them near us because they're members of our family. But it's good to know that we face no extra risk from them. But I wonder if there's a way to understand how it is then that a disease that originated in animals is something that we don't necessarily face a big risk of acquiring from animals, if that makes any sense as a question.
Viruses are survivors, and in order to survive, they undergo some changes that make them best adapted for living and surviving in a particular host species. Whether it's people or companion animals or wild animals, viruses adapt to make sure that they are best able to replicate themselves and survive in a host. And it's these adaptations to a specific host that makes it hard for them then to jump into a totally different host. To do so, they would have to undergo yet more changes that would allow them to make that jump from one species to another. And there's a lot of checks and balances that tend to keep these adaptations to a new host at a very low rate. There are lots of barriers for virus jumping from one species to another, and that may be one of the more important reasons why people are not continuously infected by new viruses originating from some animal host reservoir.
I understand. Now, have there been diseases that humans have acquired from animals in large quantities? Like, for instance, avian flu is something that I've heard of, swine flu. Are these diseases that could affect people in a substantial way?
Historically, influenza viruses that have jumped into people have come from birds, particularly ducks and geese, waterfowl. So, I mean, the great influenza pandemic of 1918 originated from birds, and the bird flu virus underwent some changes or mutations that allowed it to start infecting people, and then off it went. The greatest pandemic ever in the history of mankind was the recent history of mankind was that 1918 influenza pandemic that supposedly killed up to 50 million people. And of course, it didn't help that it occurred during World War One. There have been other pandemics from influenza. The most recent one is in 2009 with swine flu. And it's called swine flu because one of the virus was originally in pigs, and then there was some mutations with other viruses that allowed the new virus to jump into people. So that was our most recent influenza pandemic. It was in 2009. Of course, the one before that was the SARS virus in 2003, and now we have the SARS-CoV virus in 2020.
We've been discussing how the concern for our pets now is fairly low, that it would be for our household pets. Is the concern for agricultural animals any higher?
So far, there have not been any documentation of this human coronavirus infecting livestock, horses, pigs, or poultry. So there's, and this is being seen both with testing of potentially exposed livestock as well as some experimental studies that attempted to infect such species, but the virus, they could not get particularly pigs or poultry infected with the human coronavirus. So it may be that these species of animals are large species, or large animals are resistant to infection.
Okay, so then a little bit more good news. I mean, so far this conversation has reassured me in a number of areas. But here, if I can, before we take a short break, I wonder if we can talk a little bit then about if there are relatively few concerns for our pets, and if we don't need to be concerned really at all for our pets infecting us, are there things as a veterinarian that trouble you?
Yes, I think we should make plans for protection of our pets from us. If we become infected by the coronavirus, we need to protect our pets from possible infection transmission to them.
How do we best go about doing that?
Well, it would be the same as what you would do for other people or family members in the household. If you become infected, then you need to socially distance yourself or physically distance yourself from both other people in the household as well as the pets. And the best way to do this is to have other people in the household care for the pet while you yourself are ill. You should sequester yourself away into a room that is not shared by other people as well as pets. If you must care for the pet yourself while ill or infected, then you need to use precautions. You need to wear a cloth covering of your face, wash your hands thoroughly before touching the pet, its food, its bowls, its belongings, its bed, toys. And then wash your hands thoroughly again after touching them or anything belonging to them. So facial covering is second best. Having someone else care for your pet during this time of illness is best.
Do we think it's possible for an infected person, by virtue of being in the same area as an animal, might transmit some, you know, infected saliva or whatever to an animal's coat, and then that could be picked up by another person?
And that, there was a thought that that could occur early on during the COVID pandemic, but it's since been shown that pet fur is not really a stable surface for the virus to stay persist on. So the virus will persist on surfaces that are solid in terms of not having fibers or porous type surface. So the virus can survive for a few hours on tabletops, doorknobs, wood surfaces, metal surfaces, countertops, solid materials such as that. But it doesn't survive much on paper or clothing, and not been detectable in pet fur.
Well, that is a little bit more good news. We're going to take one more break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Cinder Crawford from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. Our topic today, planning for your pets in the age of COVID-19. This is Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and in this recorded episode, I'm talking to Dr. Cinder Crawford from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, and we're talking about planning for your pets in the age of COVID. And so far, I think, Dr. Crawford, we've gotten a lot of reassuring news that this disease isn't something that really adversely affects animals in a substantial way, at least as far as our pets are concerned. But I wonder if there are ways in which, while it might not be physically infecting our pets, it's changing the ways in which humans interact with animals that potentially has some negative consequences. And I'm thinking here about places like animal shelters. I imagine that animal shelters are being affected and how they are able to operate and do business, like a lot of places that have been closed down. Can you offer any insights about other ways that our animals might be affected by COVID, given the ways we've all had to change our behavior?
Shelters have had a remarkable period so far during the COVID pandemic response, in that in preparation for the unknown, not knowing what they were going to face, maybe with pets from homes, most of the shelters across the country have been able to place the pets in their shelter in foster homes and in adoption homes, to the point where many shelters across the country have the lowest number of animals in their care ever, historically. There's been an unprecedented movement of animals out of shelters into homes as part of the COVID response, which is, in terms of life-saving, is just remarkable. And the fear that people would be surrendering their pets to shelters because of COVID has not materialized. Surprisingly, very, very few pets have entered shelters during the pandemic response from homes. The ones that have their owners died from COVID, and there were no prior plans or, for family members to take the pet in case of the owner's death, or they there just were no family members to take the pet. So it's not really remarkable how shelters have responded and how the communities across the nation have supported the shelters. Again, that's unprecedented too. The community response has been overwhelming. But it's also, I think, remarkable that people are wanting to hang on to their pets during this period. So the shelters have not been negatively impacted by the COVID response at all. It's all been extremely positive, all due to the community that the shelters are in, as well as the pet owners.
And I imagine that some of this is due to smart decision making and some foresight on the part of animal services and other agencies that work to foster pets and really take care of animals. They must have responded fairly quickly to ensure that there would be a good result here.
They did respond quickly in March and early April. I don't think this country has ever experienced the number of homes serving as fosters as it occurred in March and April. Just a tremendous boom in fostering. So, you know, if it wasn't for this community response across this nation, shelters might be struggling a lot right now.
Do we know if shelters in areas around the country have reopened their doors to the public?
Yes, shelters are, like other services in our communities, are slowly restoring more functions, more normal operations, or reopening, if you want to use that phrase. But the push, the shelters have learned a lot during this COVID response. They have had to do some MacGyvering, I think is the phrase that's used, in terms of finding ways to get the animals in their care into people's homes in the community and to keep them there. And in identifying the methods that have worked the best, the next step as the country slowly reopens is to continue to utilize those methods as best practices for new ways of shelters to operate. So instead of being serving as, shall we say, a storage depot for homeless dogs and cats, I think what shelters are looking forward to being more of is a community service, an animal social services center, so to speak, that really works hard to identify best practices and resources that promote keeping pets in their homes instead of in shelters. So we're going to see a new wave of animal sheltering that has been adapted from having to respond to the COVID lockdown.
And certainly the hope is that they're able to continue these valiant efforts in spite of what seems like it might be times of economic scarcity. Perhaps a downturn in the economy could be something that affects nonprofit organizations of all kinds, and that might include animal shelters.
You are correct with that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you hinted on something really, really positive and you know, suggesting that maybe we might be able to see some lasting changes to the way that we approach some major topics of animal health and welfare. I mean, what other long-lasting changes can you imagine might be on the horizon, given the nature of this pandemic and the massive response at every level?
Well, I think one of the other positive impacts that hopefully is long-lasting is the fact that people have spent more time with their pets in the lockdown situation. So I hope there's been a great deepening and widening of the human-animal bond and recognition of the benefits derived from the interactions of people with their pets. So that is always a good thing. Again, I think a new wave of looking how pets fit into the community is going to hopefully be a long-lasting change. And perhaps there will be less need for shelters in each community, again, to serve as a home for homeless pets. And the community itself steps up to take in these pets.
I do think it's not hard to imagine that our pets, dogs in particular, quite like our young children who are spending a lot of time at home with their parents, are probably thinking, this is the greatest. You know, my human companions are with me all the time. This is everything I wanted. And there are lots of times to go outside and go for walks and so forth.
This has been probably, 7 or 8 weeks of the most dog walking in America in history.
Right.
I have had nothing but a continuous parade of people with their dogs walking through my neighborhood for the past 8 weeks. So that is great. That's health benefits all the way around for both people and the dog.
Before I say goodbye, can we talk just a little bit about how regular veterinary services have been affected? Are there fewer people bringing their pets to veterinarians' offices right now?
Well, during the lockdown phase of the pandemic response, yes. The veterinary clinics across the nation switched to providing services only for pets that had emergency conditions. And those are the pets that they would see somehow in a veterinary clinic using the appropriate precautions, wearing the appropriate protective gear, and so forth. Those pets that didn't have a life-threatening condition, just needed some routine wellness care, have been put on pause. They've been asked to wait until we flatten the curve and it's safe to reopen the clinic as well as other community services. What has happened with this is a big boom in telemedicine. People are very familiar, I think, with telemedicine with regard to communication with physicians, their physicians. But now we have experienced a big rise in telemedicine in veterinary medicine, where people can connect with their veterinarian that they have a relationship with to discuss a concern for their pet via telephone or via Zoom or some other meeting platform. And this is another, I hope, long-lasting outcome of the COVID response, and that we will retain in veterinary medicine, just like in human medicine, the telemedicine mechanism for communication about pets that doesn't necessarily require a visit to the veterinary clinic. One of the negative impacts of the COVID response on veterinary medicine, of course, is the same on practically every other service or job, and that is loss of revenue, possibly furloughing employees as tied to the economic impact. Hopefully there won't be just complete closures of veterinary clinics, but because they can't recover, they have no hope of financial recovery. But I think that, you know, veterinary clinics in terms of operating as a business will be just as susceptible to the negative impacts of the economic downturn associated with the COVID response.
Well, we do hope then that, if anything, the economic recovery allows people to care for their pets' health as they have enjoyed a kind of new connection with their pets, that they've maybe established a deeper sort of ties to their animals during this time, that they've spent with them even more closely than before, that the telemedicine aspect will enhance access to veterinarians and the services and advice that they can give, and that people will still, of course, continue to see their veterinarians for things like vaccines and checkups when that is required.
Yes, yes. And so we're slowly returning now to the point where those animals needing wellness care and just maintenance care, preventive care, that were put on pause during the past 8 weeks, now they will start to be able to go back to the veterinarian to get those services and caught up on the maintenance care.
Well, Dr. Cindy Crawford, thank you so, so much for talking to me this afternoon. This conversation about caring for your pets in the age of COVID-19 has, I think, been very helpful and illuminating, and I appreciate all the work you're doing.
Thank you for this opportunity.
That was Dr. Cindy Crawford from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. You've been listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. My name is Dana Hill.